Hey, this is Chris.
This is Greg.
We're here joined by our very first advertiser. We have Jason Stapleton.
The Jason Stapleton.
He is a true professional. If you go to jasonstapleton.com and you look at his podcast, it's amazing. Jason, it's a pleasure to have you as a sponsor of the podcast. We encourage all of our listeners to go and listen to your show. Tell us a little bit about what you do over at jasonstapleton.com.
Well, thank you very much for having me, because I paid you.
Yeah.
No, we would have had you on anyway. Yeah. I've been wanting to do this for
Chris
a while.
Chris and I have been talking for a long time. So, I've been a very big fan of your show for a long time, too. And I was telling Chris before the show started, you know, what I really like about your show is I feel like I'm sitting in the living room with you guys, and I feel like it is just a filterless conversation about what's happening in the world from a libertarian perspective, and I think we need more of that. And I just really like your perspective and what you guys bring to the table. So it's a good show.
Do we have to pay you now? Is that how this works?
No, that's you get that one for free.
All right, thanks, buddy. Jason, tell us about the show. What do you do? You broadcast every single day. That must be grueling.
So I do the show 5 days a week, and what we try and do is we try and take what's happening in the news every day and approach it from a libertarian angle. And I try and show how using a libertarian mentality or libertarian approach to the problem will create more wealth, more prosperity, more opportunity for more people than any other possible, structure. And so that's what we try and do every day. And I have a very condensed timeline because I own a couple of other businesses. This is a side business that I'm trying to turn into a primary business. And that's a slow process. But we've been at it for almost a year now. And it's growing. So I'm very happy with the progress, and people who are coming are saying great things about it. And if any of your listeners want to head on over there and check it out, you can download it on iTunes. You can go to YouTube and catch the video version. You can watch it live streaming from our studio if you go to jasonstapleton.com. However you want to do it, it doesn't matter.
I'll tell you what, you have the most impressive video. It is so beautiful. And I professionally, I do video and audio broadcasting and video encoding, and you have the prettiest studio, the prettiest stream. I love the look of your show. It's beautiful.
Thank you very much. A lot of people say that it was a very expensive process, but one I wanted to do. I have a belief that a message, you create a lot more message visually when people can see you. And I built several other businesses using video, and I wanted to do the same thing with this podcast. But far more people listen to the audio version than go and watch the video version. But just getting another media form out there and having the space. One of the things I want to do with the studio is have people come in and sit down and do sit-down interviews with folks. We've been discussing with at least one of the potential libertarian candidates about having a debate at the studio.
Ooh.
And bringing both of them in to do a head-to-head debate. So a lot of that stuff is stuff we want to use that studio for. But yeah, it's been a work in progress for about a year now.
Well, it is beautiful, and he is being humble, asking you to politely go download the Jason Stapleton Show in iTunes. I, as dear leader, am commanding you.
A fatwa.
This is a commandment from the We Are Libertarians crew to go and download the Jason Stapleton Show. Go to jasonstapleton.com, view the video. There's a lot of different ways to engage with Jason. I think you will, if you're a fan of this show, you will definitely like his show. And, you know, Jason, thank you for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your host, Chris Spangle, and across the table is the effervescent and beautiful Greg Lenz.
That is the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me.
Thank you,
Chris. How are you? You're looking quite radiant as well.
I am. I had a 20-minute power nap, and I'm ready to go. And then to your right is the handsome Mittens, and she is bothering the crap out of you.
I am not a pet person, and cats make me nervous, so I'm a bit put off by this. I don't know what she's staring at, but she's already been clawing at my boots.
All right, and then joining us over Skype is the even handsomer. I mean, you put the best features of Greg Lenz and I together, and you wouldn't equal one Jason Stapleton. Jason, thanks for joining us here on the show.
Well, that's nice of you. And I haven't seen both of you, but you sound ravaging.
Oh my God, we are podcasters.
We're gorgeous radio podcasters.
As far as podcasters go, we have less acne than most of them.
Exactly. Especially libertarian podcasters. Right.
With a rapist wit.
Jason is at jasonstapleton.com. He is a good friend of mine and has a daily show, a beautiful show on both video and a great sounding show on audio. In iTunes, you can catch it on YouTube. You can check it out at jasonstapleton.com. Jason, you are a professional. And I say this as one broadcaster to another. I professionally do video encoding, audio encoding. Your setup makes me incredibly jealous. The first time I saw your video, I immediately hated you because it looks so much better than anything that We Are Libertarians has or probably will ever put out. I think your dedication is amazing. Like, how did you get started? First, well, philosophy aside, let's podcast nerd out, Greg.
All right.
I want to know how did you decide to start your own daily podcast? Because Greg and I, much to the chagrin of our listeners, we're so fortunate that the only complaint that our listeners have is that we don't put out enough shows. Well, there's other complaints, but we don't listen to you people.
We meme them.
Right. We make memes of you, and they're very cruel. And we have this little Alesis Multimix 8, and we've got some SM48 microphones. And then you turn on Jason's stuff at his go to YouTube and check it out. It's so pretty. Or go to jasonstapleton.com. The setup that you have is amazing. It's beautiful. Like, how did you decide, all right, I'm going to start doing a podcast, and I'm going to go balls to the walls, and I'm going to do it right?
Well, it didn't start out that way. I guess the Reader's Digest version is I'm a pretty decent currency trader, and I have done well in the currency markets, and I've also done rather well in the business world teaching other people. So I have education products, and that's one of the companies that I own that teach and deliver those. And I spent a long time coaching traders on how to make decisions. And in the currency markets, a lot of what you deal with is economic and politically related. You need to understand how central banks work, and the decisions that one government makes may affect another government, and what's going to cause these and how it's going to affect currency prices. And so that was something that I understood a great deal about. But it's not something that you can really talk about, because you're dealing with people from all over the world with very different opinions about the way the world works. And the worst thing that you can do if you want to turn off somebody who's getting ready to hand you money is to start talking about politics and religion. I could touch on the economic stuff, but not the other stuff. And for years, I sat around going, you know what? I think I want to start a show. I mean, those guys on the radio, this is how arrogant I am. Those guys on the radio, I can do that. I can do what those guys do.
We had on Rob Kendall last week. Trust me, you can't be more arrogant than Rob Kendall.
All right. Well, and I said, I think I could do that. And I had this space. We had leased about 4,000 square feet when we moved offices down out of Kansas City. And I had about a 600 square foot space that we didn't know what we were going to do with. It was just there. And we said, well, we'll take that too. And so that sat dormant for about a year. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to build a studio in here, and I'm going to use it for a little bit of training stuff. But really what I'm going to use it for is I'm going to start that radio show, and I'm going to stream it Glenn Beck style with video and everything, just like he does. And I'm going to compete with him. And so what I did was I went to my business partner. I said, hey, I want to spend about $10,000 to build this studio out. And he's like, really? What are you going to do with it? I said, I don't know, but I'll figure out a way to make the money with it. And he goes, okay, we'll start. That's fine. Go ahead and do that. So I went to work and put it together, a couple of cameras, a little desk and stuff, and kind of made it look cool. And I thought, this looks pretty cool. I only need another $90,000 to finish it off.
So, oh, my goodness.
So I did it slowly. I would go to him and I'd say, I'm gonna do something here, and maybe I just need to buy this piece of equipment. I need a TriCaster in order to stream live, right? Oh. And so I said, that's $40,000, but I can get a deal. I can get it for only 30. I can save us 10 grand.
I know a
and
guy.
He's like, and he's sweating. I know my partner. He's sweating bullets over there. And I'm like, he's like, all right, man, whatever you want to do, we'll make it. You can spend it. And so we ended up building out this really nice studio over time. And while I was building it out, I ran about 7 test episodes of the show. And I was going to do it once a week And by the time I got done doing it once a week, I said, you know what? I think I can fit this into my schedule. I think I can do this every day. And so now we do it every day. I get into the office about 6 o'clock. I've got currency stuff I have to do. And then from about 8 to 10, I do show prep. And from 10 to 11, we do the show live. And I did everything wrong. I shoot the show live every day with no breaks, no edits, no nothing. I stream it over the internet, which requires a massive amount of components, and I do video.
Right.
So I have no guests on my show either. That's another thing. I do an hour on my own.
Why do you think I have Greg on this podcast and there's like 15 other libertarians locally that rotate in here? Because I'm trying to mask all of my flaws as a host. Come on, kid.
No, you do fine. But no, but those are things that everybody tells you not to do. They're like, oh yeah, you've got to have guests because that's what everybody does.
Right.
And, you know, you don't ever do it once a day and don't do it live. And I was just like, whatever. I'll do it just like a radio show.
No, I think
and that'll save me on edit time.
Yeah, I think you did it just the right. I mean, we don't edit this at all, and we don't have really guests. I mean, like people think that like Rob Kendall last week was a guest, but he's a guest, but without being a guest, you know. Like, and when we've tried to do guests over the course of it, it is such a pain in the butt. And you know, like trying to get Ron Paul and Noam Chomsky and
they're so bad. That's what I always hate.
Get it? Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's
that was. I'm not going to beg, borrow, and steal for a guest. If somebody was to call me up and they had something really cool to say or talk about, or if there was somebody that I know who is a better expert on something than I am, then I'll invite them on. But it's a pain. Like
The
other day, the bond market they've got all this money from China all these bonds are getting sold in China. Bond market's not moving. And I'm like, why is that? I don't have any idea. I need to find a bond expert. So I go and I call 3 different bond experts. I leave voice messages with them. And I'm like, hey, I'm a nationally syndicated radio show host because I am now. I got picked up with USA Radio Networks. And I want to ask you some questions about the bond market. You can come on the show if you want to, but I just really want to talk to you. Nobody responds. And I'm like, why am I going to all this effort? I'll just make something up.
Yeah.
Exactly. You'll just trump it. You're going to trump it.
Right, I'll trump it.
I'm going to make America great with their bonds.
Yeah, I am totally with you. And like, in all fairness to Joe, you know, Joe Ruiz, part of the triumvirate of We Are Libertarians here, he loves interviews and wants us to do more interviews because then we get their audience into our audience. And there is a lot of truth to that. You know, like when we were in Tom Wood's podcast, that's when we grew the most, is because he put us in as one of his first episodes when he was on an interview here with us. And so we got a lot of exposure out of it. But it is also very the whole point of this is that it is relaxed and that it is fun and that it is, you know, sort of us shooting the stuff. And interviews just get so stressful. So that's why we don't do a lot of them. And the other reason is that we do it because we have something to say. Like, I started this podcast because I felt like I'm arrogant enough, or confident enough, I prefer to say, that I know what I'm talking about. I've got a certain level of experience. I have to get these opinions and these points of view out, and I want to ask these questions, and I have all these smart friends that I want to invite on and have these conversations, and we can build a little community around it. And I think that's why you did it right, is because you've got something that you want to say. You know, you have much more to say going 5 times a week. I don't know how you find that much to say. Like, Greg and I were talking about it. It's like, oh, you know, we...
Well, to act genuinely be interested in something. Like, it's one thing to know it, and I'm always amazed you have an opinion on something that I struggle to get fired up about.
Right.
You know, or something. It bothers me, but not to the point I'm going to, pour over it and offer a unique perspective on how to, you know, like from an analysis perspective.
You know what? Truth be told, some days are easier than others.
Yeah.
Some days you walk in and you're like, man, I could talk for 3 hours today. All this stuff gets me going. Mm-hmm. And other days you're like, because I have the guy who helps me produce the show, Darren. A lot of times I just like, man, please tell me, find something in the news today that's newsworthy that we can talk about.
Because
you know, all they're pushing on mainstream media is crap. And so you've got to dig kind of deep, and one of the big struggles for us has been making sure that the stuff that we're talking about legitimately happened. Because mm-hmm. when you're forced out of mainstream news into secondary and tertiary news sites,
oh,
you
boy.
Get a lot of, you know, misinformation. And so a big problem for us has just been validating and verifying the stuff that's happening in the world as legitimate.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I love about yours, because I'm not a big listener to like Free Talk Live. But, you know, you stick to such mainstream, or not mainstream, but like you analyze things that maybe aren't being covered, right, you know, that night on by CNN, but are actually most important to what, you know, I believe Americans should be listening to.
Well, the goal of the show that I do is not really geared towards the converted, you know, the saved, right, so to speak.
The pure.
The libertarians, we have lots of libertarians who listen. They're the anchor of the show. They come back every single day. But I am trying to reach the unclean. I'm trying to reach those people who are disenfranchised, who don't feel like they fit in a political party, or who are angry at Republicans because they're not, you know, they've lost their conservative or their liberty base.
Yeah.
And I want those guys to be able to put a name to what they believe in. And so that's why we try and stick to those types of issues. I try not to stray too far off the path, because I want it to be relevant to them and their lives every day.
Yeah, and that's sort of what we found, too, is surprisingly, we're a lot of people's first introduction into libertarianism. And so we do take that. We are irreverent, but we also we are unfiltered. And I don't know why Greg looked at me when you said that.
I've never had to be edited out for cursing.
Gina. Yeah. I may say a lot of things that I should regret. I don't at all, but but you know, we are the introduction, and that's why at wearelibertarians.com, you know, we have the path to libertarianism, which is just a very simple path, you know, through three big ideas of libertarianism, and then a guide to the libertarian community. We have a lot of resources as to, you know, hey, here are the big think tanks, here are other libertarian podcasts, here are other, you know, here's various outlets, just because most people think it's really confusing and really hard, but it isn't. And I think podcasts are a great way to reach those people who, you know, they sit there in their cubicle at work and they are kind of lost and they don't know. It's not that they don't know what to think. It's just that they're not connecting with what they hear in the mainstream media. And so podcasting is a great alternative to hit that. And you certainly are high up. I mean, gosh, you're in what, the top 50 of news and politics? Like, what's your iTunes ranking?
It depends on the day, but yeah, we'll get up into the top 50. We typically hover around 80 area. I watch that stuff pretty close. But it's the marketer in me. I want to know what my numbers are and all that stuff. So I've got a measuring stick. But I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the big problem is a lot of people are terribly, woefully uninformed. And when they meet a libertarian, because to call yourself a libertarian is to really paint yourself with a very broad brush. And when they meet a libertarian, instantly they start talking about man, economy and state, and you know, the government is corrupt, and what we need is to burn this whole system to the ground. And after about 60 seconds, you're really seriously believing that this guy has got a hole in his backyard and he's stockpiling food and weapons for the end of times. And all of their arguments are nuanced and difficult to articulate and understand. And I said, we've just got to condense this thing down. And I love Matt Kibbe's book. The title of that book's Don't Hurt People and Don't Take Their Stuff.
Yep.
And I said, you could not find a clearer definition of what libertarianism is. At its core, we believe we shouldn't hurt people and we shouldn't take their stuff. So guess what we talk about on my show? I created five principles of liberty, and I largely the same thing that you guys do here. It's a very condensed version of what we believe, that everything from we're pro-peace, we're pro-free markets, we believe that liberty should be a primary political value, you know, and on down the line. And so we create these things, and it gives people something to anchor themselves to. They say, yeah, I agree with those things. I'm a libertarian. And then you could get into Bastiat's The Law and the Anatomy of the State by Rothbard later on down the road if you so choose. But it's real easy for you to know whether or not you belong to what it is that we're doing.
So have you found libertarians can be a bunch of jerks?
not ours or Jason's subscribers, but the
some
rest.
Some of our listeners. Josiah Crones, total jerk. Josiah is our least favorite listener, Jason.
Josiah is. I have mine.
Okay, yeah.
Just pray that the Crohn's disease doesn't come to your page.
Yeah, you don't want the Crohn's disease visiting your page planting...
potatoes.
He's from Idaho. He's from Idaho, so he's pretending to go to law school. So he gets so mad when we do this, but he loves it. We know he does. He's sitting there rubbing his nipples right now. So
I just pictured Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill.
He actually friended Greg, and so Greg got access to all of his photos.
No, he didn't friend me. He blocked me. And then I went online and researched him and found his senior photos by the photographer that did them. And because he, you know, he likes to think, you know, as all teenagers do, you know, he's like 20. And he thought, oh, I'll show this guy how to internet. And then he blocked me within about a half hour.
So we are fortunate that most of our listeners, like 99.9%, are awesome, and we get helpful criticism. Like, we get really respectful people who write in and say, hey, have you really thought this through? Or, hey, Chris, you really should not have said that thing about Aunt Donna, which was a thing. And love you, Jason. it wasn't this Jason, it was a different one.
Oh.
Have you had any pushback from the purity Nazis who listen to your show and then send you an 1800 bullet point, all single spaced, type 0.8 font in Times New Roman, pointing out all of your philosophical flaws? Or have people been pretty open and accepting to a new voice in the libertarian community?
Well, I think most of the blowback, the answer is yes and no. Overwhelmingly, the response has been positive. And the people have been very open to what I would consider to be a new idea of how we approach libertarianism in society. And I have had the hardliners. I love the way that you called them purists, because I use the same term. It's those folks who are, I don't want to call them part of the old guard, because they're not all part of the old guard, but there are people who don't understand that there are steps involved with getting what you want, that they will only accept total and complete surrender on the part of their enemy. And they're not going to fight any battles. They're not going to engage in conflict. They're just going to wait for their enemy to either die of old age so that they can take over, or they're going to just abuse their enemy until their enemy finally gives up and gives them everything that they want.
Right.
And so you're right. What you get are these, you've got all kinds of flaws in your argument. And those people tend to lose those arguments because it's not as though I just woke up yesterday and came at the opinions that I had.
Yeah.
I do this for a living.
I'm not
so
on Fox News.
I kind of understand what it is that I believe and why I believe it. One of the biggest things I get is we made the comment the other day. I said, I can figure out, because I'm very clear on the limitations of my own belief system. So I would say, I believe taxation is theft, right? I don't think we should have any taxation. The problem is, I can understand in theory how we get rid of all taxes except a tax that would provide for the common defense. I can't figure out how to make that work. And I was telling people on the show, much to my own dismay, that I have yet to figure out, although I still believe that their taxes, that taxes are wrong, I haven't figured out a way to do it. And all the blowback. You should have heard these guys.
Right.
Well, you should read this and this and this. There are tons of ways out there. And I'm like, no. You act like I'm an idiot. Like I'm just sitting around dreaming this stuff up and I've never read a book.
Right.
You know, all of these arguments that you give, I understand them. I just don't believe that they'll work.
Yeah.
And so that and I didn't get into the specifics about why, because that would just get more people angry. But yeah, I absolutely have those people. And what I did was I spent about 30 minutes on one of my shows talking about putting the right people on the bus.
Yep.
And I said, this is what I believe. This is what you're going to hear on this show. And if this show is not, if this isn't what you want to hear every day, then you need to leave, because I got to get the right people on the bus if we're going to take this movement and move it forward. And I got a couple of people who sent me emails and said, hey, I heard about you on the Tom Woods show. Let me just tell you what, not a fan. I'm off the bus. And well, you know what? I don't hate that guy. I don't have any, I have no hard feelings from that guy, but he's not my guy. He's not my audience. And it's best that he does leave, because he's just going to be frustrated and angry the longer he listens. Because
the more it gains momentum, the more he's going to support you anyway. Yeah. It's not like he's going to, you know, go start his own thing.
Well, that's what I said. I said, here's the thing, is that at the end of the day, my goal is to be somewhere further down the line towards Liberty 10 years from now.
Right.
And the interesting thing about it is, I know enough about marketing, I know enough about positioning to know how you start a movement, to know how you create authority. And so I'm in the process of developing that right now, and my goal is to become nothing short of a spokesperson for liberty in this country. And what's going to happen is 10 years from now, I'm going to be much further along than they are. They're still going to be in the same place that they were 10 years ago. And they're going to be yelling and talking about me and talking bad about me while I'm working on making a difference. And so what I try and tell people is, if you stand with liberty, you'll find a friend with me. Well, I don't care who you are or what you believe. If you stand with liberty, I'll stand with you.
And there's so much to unpack in that. We'll talk about your ride on the Liberty train here in a minute. Remind me, Greg.
There are no stops on
there. There are no. It's happening. but you touched on, and that's why we have taken this show. If you listen to the arc of the shows, it certainly follows my personality from enthusiastic Libertarian Party leader to. Tired,
disillusioned, overwhelmed,
too pissed off over Edward Snowden. To now we're sort of in the Oprah phase of the We Are Libertarians episodes, because I'm about personal freedom. In every single area of my life, I want to strive to be personally free, and that's why I'm a Christian. That's why I'm a libertarian. That's why. You know, I'm in therapy, and as I have gone through that process and sort of unpacked some of my own history and learned about thinking patterns and cognition, a door has been kind of opened for me. And so we've tried to talk a lot about what it means to be a good human being, because I think that is essential to personal liberty and personal freedom. You can't have a society of broken people, because then you do end up with Rwanda, where you have to have morals and principles and values, and you have to be able to evaluate yourself. And so much of what I find in the liberty movement is broken personalities, I guess. You know, people who are very angry and very upset because... frankly, you people have not dealt with the traumas of your past, and your cognition is poor. And if you can't think properly, if you can't, I don't know, what's the word? Cognate? Tell me.
Process.
Process. If you can't have no self-awareness.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
Then, you know, it really started with the Melissa interview, Melissa Hubbard, and fear and reaching self-actualization. Like, that to me sort of clicked at the exact right time. And moving past fear, it just clicked with me. And so we've spent a lot of time lately talking about what it means to just be a good person and how to reach out to people and to live a life of courage and to speak your beliefs without worrying about what other people think about you. And, you know, when I hear Jason just talk about that, like, I hear a guy who is comfortable in himself, comfortable in his beliefs, who is not trying to... not like I always had this problem. I need to know everything and be an expert about everything, or else I am a failure. And that is just not a rational thing.
No,
that's not possible. That's not rational. You can't do it, people. And so many of these purist trolls think that if you're a voice in the liberty movement, that you have to be that way. And secondly, that they think that we care what they think because they desperately care what other people think. Like, I know I don't know everything. I know that my personality and my life and my words and my thoughts and my beliefs are not always all consistent. That's part of being a human being. And I'm not a robot. Sorry, you little INTJs. I'm a wild and free ENFJ, and I know that drives
you're
you all
a gypsy.
Crazy. I am. I'm a free spirit.
Yes.
But, you know, we need people who are secure in themselves to just say, listen, I don't know everything, but I'm going to try and do my best to fool you. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, and like people like get really mad at you if context makes you at least rethink something.
Yeah.
You know, like for instance, when there's like the Boston bombing, that can... A traumatic event can cause you to go back and re-examine what you'd maybe previously said.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. As long as you stick to your principles and then arrive at the libertarian, the voluntarist, you know, position, whichever minarchist, anarchist side, as long as you are open to that, because what I find so often is everyone's closed off to any new perspective.
Yeah.
There's no room for diversity within the libertarian analysis. It is either the NAP is literally from Mount Sinai, you know, God gave it to Moses and came down on tablets, or you're a Republican. There's no in between.
Yeah. And so how did you get to a point, because it is uncomfortable. Like, it was really uncomfortable 3.5 years ago when I started this podcast, and I just started saying, you know, hey, I'm, sorry, breaking news alert. It's about a fire. I was really uncomfortable with making myself a voice of authority. And I talked to my little buddy, Lauren Rumpler, Objectivist Girl. Check out some of the stuff Lauren's doing. She's in New Hampshire, and she has become a libertarian. A celebritarian is what they call themselves. And I was talking to her. She's like, you know, you can get away with stuff because you're not a celebritarian. And at first I was like, how dare you? Don't you know who I am?
God.
But I'm glad.
Oh, this fancy pants. She's got to watch her words because she's famous now.
Yeah. Don't you know? I had a tweet from a young lady this week who said, it's my cover photo. Go check it out. But, you know, I had a real like, hey, I don't know if I should make myself a voice of authority. Who am I? And then I sort of thought about it. I was like, you know what? I have more political experience, marketing experience, government experience, reporting experience than almost all of the libertarians I come into contact. Who says I can't be a voice of authority? And I'll grow with it. So, like, how did you decide, hey, I'm qualified to be a voice of authority, and how did you get comfortable with that and just decide to make the leap? Because so much of what we've talked about is saying you're good enough, you're smart enough, and gosh darn it, people will like you. You just have to take the jump and actually start doing that thing that you want to do.
Well, yeah, and I think to start off with, I mean, I'm incredibly overconfident all the time. As I said, you know, I'm just that arrogant that I think I can do things. But no, my authority issues got killed a long time ago when I was trading currencies and I wanted to start teaching people what I knew. And I was, you know, I was really uncomfortable about it. And I would put out these videos and try and show people what I was doing. And then I started putting a little course material together. And then anytime you start doing that, people start bad mouthing you and they start criticizing your work and your analysis. And when you get when you call things wrong, they get angry and they, oh, you know, you're such a scammer and all this other nonsense. And I learned to let that go a long time ago. And I learned that if I wanted to get my message across, if I wanted to be a real help to people, I needed to be an authority figure. That was something that I needed to take on. And so I had been doing that for several years in the currency market. I mean, if you are in the currency market, if you're an independent currency trader, there is a 99.9% chance you know who I am. I have the biggest website for currency trade, or the biggest YouTube page for currency trading on YouTube. I have one of the largest and most successful trading companies in the world. We serve, you know, tens of thousands of people in 110 different countries. See, I can talk myself up. It's because I'm that arrogant.
Let's say confident. We don't use arrogant here. Arrogant means that you've not earned your success.
Oh, okay.
Let's say confident, okay? Arrogance.
Well, super confident then.
Arrogance is hollow.
But so what I'm saying is if you, I am a, for lack of a better term, a celebrity to a small, very niche group of people who do that for fun or for a living. And so when I moved over into the space of talking about liberty, my biggest concern was alienating all of my clients. Come to find out, because I didn't tell any of them that I was doing it. I just kind of started it. But come to find out, a lot of them figured it out anyway, and they've come over and started watching the show, and they really like it. But for me, I I used to be a, I don't know if, how much you want to get into my history. I was in the military for a while. After I got out of the military, I was a mercenary. I worked for Blackwater. Mercenary is such a strong word.
Crank call. Gotta go. Hey.
Yeah. And I worked for Blackwater for a number of years. And that was when I really got to see the war from a new angle, from the angle of big government,
mm-hmm.
and all the problems that it created, and what we were really doing there versus what we said we were doing there. And you just come away very jaded with the whole thing. And I was searching for answers because I grew up in a Republican household with people who believed that you don't talk bad about the country, and you wear the flag on your shirt and on your heart, and you support the military no matter what. And I went to serve the military to defend liberty and freedom around the world. You know, I swallowed that whole pill.
Mm-hmm.
And then come to find out when I finally got into it, I'm like, man, I don't think I believe what I've believed my whole life. But I didn't know what you called that. What did I believe? And I read a book by Ron Paul called The Revolution, A Manifesto. And a very small book, but it was like somebody took what I felt and they put it into words I could understand. And I'm like, oh, that's what I believe. That's who I am. And that started a very long journey towards the libertarian perspective that I now hold. But you're right. I don't have the answers to everything. And I think the simplest way to do that is just to explain to people, I don't have all the answers, that I don't know how this would work. That, yeah, we could privatize the roads. I think that might work. But I've never actually tried that, and I can't find a modern day example in an industrialized nation where they have privatized roads.
And no one's put together a good plan for like an incremental process.
And so if you want to debate it and talk about the pros and cons, that's fine, but don't come at me like you got it all figured out and like you know how it would all work, because you don't know anything.
Right.
You don't know how it would work. And so at least have the intellectual courage to say, look, this is what I believe, and I think we can make it work, and here's how, without saying you're stupid for not agreeing with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree more. You know, one, I didn't have the I wasn't a mercenary. I'm not that macho, so I will be the beta to your alpha. However, I had an early experience of realizing that authority was kind of a house of cards. And I think I was like a libertarian in like third grade and knew it my whole life. And yet it wasn't until I had always been the beat your chest Dick Cheney Republican,
mm-hmm.
you know, they hate us for our freedom and let's go give them democracy. Mm-hmm. And then as I got more exposed first to the philosophy of libertarianism, I realized that's what I truly believed. And then as I was on with Chris, invited me to be on worst decision he's ever made, cause I never left. It was an I realized that it was a movement where the end point was very well. I mean, everyone that's been an early libertarian has defined what they think it might look like at the end. No one, I mean, almost no one has ever developed a process from getting to A to B. It's like, well, obviously society will collapse, currencies will be worthless, and then we'll just all be subsistence farmers and trade very happily.
The hipsters will take over.
Right. And, you know, I thought that really bugged me too and made me reconsider, you know, libertarianism.
That's a terrible world. I don't want to live in that world.
No.
Not only that, but most of these guys are peaceniks. They wouldn't survive 5 minutes in that type of world.
Or
they would come along with a machete and chop their heads
off. Yeah,
Or they're super aggressive anarchists who, you know, like Maya, who were running around with AK-47s waiting for the world to collapse so they can take over.
Why isn't it growing?
See, that's always funny to me, too, because those people would die in a heartbeat. It's so funny. They do all this food prep and storage. I don't want to get off on a tangent,
yeah.
But trust me.
That's what we do here.
I'm a pretty dangerous person if I need to be.
Right.
And if the whole world comes crashing down, you and your little AK-47 is not going to stop me and my tactical team from coming and taking everything that you have.
Right.
Let me just put it that way.
Exactly.
If it comes down to me or you, it's me. And so I just, that whole philosophy too, but why would you want to live in that world? Why would you want to live in a world where everything collapses? You got to go back to, you know, plowing your own food, and digging your own, digging your own latrines.
We're literally going to reverse the division of labor. So everybody does everything, you know, specifically for themselves, but now you're free.
And there are people who are advocating for this. They're like sitting around waiting for it to happen, and they're excited about the fact that they're finally going to be right and the whole thing is going to come crashing down. And I'm just like, man, that is just, not only is that unappealing to anyone that you're trying to convert, but it ought to be unappealing to you.
Right. You know, I've always felt, you've seen The Matrix, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Cyrus when he had taken the pill and gone over to that side and wanted to go back and be plugged back in? That's the way I've always felt.
Right.
I've experienced The Matrix, and I'm on the reform The Matrix side. I don't want to go over to reality.
I think it's just, it's dreaming of dystopian futures is just so silly to me. I mean, I had this conversation with a friend who is, let me relate it to a very personal level, okay? I was talking to a friend today. She has a new boyfriend. She really likes the new boyfriend, and she is worried that the boyfriend is going to dump her at any moment when she messes it up. And I just said to her, so you're going to live in fear and anxiety over something that may or may not happen in the future and neglect the joy of living right now. And so many libertarians have that attitude about the future. It's like, I'm just going to prep, and I'm going to be anxious, and I'm going to wait for the whole world to collapse, and it's all going to fall apart, to the point that you become such a crazy nut job to your friends and family that they don't listen to you because you're just like, I've gone through this period. I mean, I was actually getting out of my car the other day thinking, God, remember when I was starting to become a prepper? Remember when I was starting to think about all the global collapse? Oh, yeah. Look at my fridge.
I just thought that's because you were like a vegan kayaker.
No. That's not like my prepping stuff. This is back in the day. But I mean, I was really paranoid about like us getting FEMA camped for having this podcast. And then I really started to think like, that is crazy and delusional and it's not going to happen and stop it. You know, like it's mental illness. Stop it. Like it's not that the currency couldn't collapse. It's not that these things may or may not happen. And there's nothing wrong with making sure that you're prepared. You know, but when you're posting, you know, that's why the Ron Paul, it's happening. You did nothing, but you could have stopped it, but you did nothing.
I tried
nothing.
To warn you.
Right. Yeah. I tried to warn you where you see Ron Paul in fire and flames and skull. It's so funny to me because, like, it's not only is it funny because it's goofy, it's also kind of mocking.
It's trolling the people who need trolled.
Right. The people who, at any moment, the world is going to collapse, the end is nigh, and eventually, that paranoia and anxiety and fear is going to take you personally to a place where you are the Christian church that is saying the world was supposed to end yesterday, and the world never ends. You know, it's just not healthy. It's not. It's not that it's not possible. It's just that it's probably not probable. So let's focus on right now and what we can do. You know, you can't affect the outcome of the speakership.
No.
You know, you can't. You can be interested in that. Mm-hmm. You can have an opinion on that. But let's be honest, you're not going to whip up votes to get the speaker elected. You don't have control over that. You have control over your local, county, and somewhat state-level elections. You have an effect over the candidates that are running in your district. You know, that's how you can affect this stuff. Or, you know, start your own podcast.
Yeah.
Because the world needs
and
more.
And I think you're absolutely right. So, and that was, honestly, that was the rationale when I started the show.
Good.
Was I don't want to be one of these guys who is talking about the end of times and about how, and I also don't want to be somebody who's just yelling, talking about how Rome is burning all the time either, because we got plenty of people like that. I wanted to take a tactical approach to say, look, you're here. You believe in what we believe in. How do you advance the message of liberty? Because I really think it starts around your kitchen table.
Oh,
it starts with you talking to the guy at work who's across the desk from you when the subject of politics comes up, or when you start talking about economics and what's happening around the world with Greece and things like that. Those are prime opportunities, but somebody's got to understand. They've got to have the tools. They've got to have the points and the angle and the understanding about what's happening to articulate the libertarian message. And that's what I'm trying to create.
I think you do. I think you do an excellent job. I've always kind of thought of it as our job. And then there's very few libertarian authorities that I listen to, just because a lot of it is more fringe coverage of news stories that you can't verify. But I think it's our job to provide that like mental scaffolding for somebody that's a disillusioned Republican and sees that it's Jeb Bush, Donald Trump, and then a neurosurgeon from John Hopkins that's never won an election. And this person's been a lifelong Republican that's actually serious. And then they look, you know, they actually have read the Constitution, and, it, you know, that means something to them. And they say, well, where's my guy? And they see Rand, and maybe Rand doesn't turn him on. Our job is to provide that almost that bridge and that mental scaffolding for the seeds of liberty to grow up it over to our position. And I think that you do an excellent job of that, Jason.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I think that you're exactly right. I think that for the most part, people feel terribly inadequate to challenge others and to do so without coming off sounding like a raving lunatic or B, an a-hole. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that if you can just provide them a little bit of context and say, hey, listen, the goal is not to defeat them. The goal is not to make them feel bad and to take their beliefs and throw them in the garbage can. The goal is to slowly move their mind towards liberty. And you can do that if you have constant daily contact with people. And so whether it's, you know, the guy next to you at work or the guy that you're sitting across the pew from at church or whatever it is, when the subject comes up, at least you have the tools.
Exactly.
So how you've done the show for what, a year?
Just under a year, yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, have you met – it's hard to quantify. I mean, off air, you kind of told us we put it on the table and we compared a little bit. And you made us feel very good about ourselves and our size and how much we've grown as a
the pleasure we're bringing others.
Right. The generous
your show has depth and girth.
Right. but I was really surprised to hear how well we're doing. You're like, hey, you guys are really a top podcast.
Yes. There are very few that are doing the type of numbers consistently that you guys are doing.
And not just in the libertarian world, you meant it in all podcasts.
Yeah, no, most podcasts stink, guys.
Totally.
Most of them really do. Your average podcaster is going to have somewhere around 400 people downloading their show every day.
And we're somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000. We're somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 at this point.
Yeah, which puts you in almost, I think 5,000 is a top 20% podcast. And wow. So, you guys are almost in the top 20% of you're a 20%er. You know, you're not an 80%er, you're a 20%.
So
doing something right.
Just because we bear all here, we won't ask you to share your numbers, but have you met your measure of success at this point a year out?
I think we are. I had no idea when I started, because it's a new media for me, I had no idea what to expect. We are seeing growth somewhere around 40% a month.
Wow.
And if that will hold for a few more months, I would like to get to a point where, because for me, this is about monetizing. I need mm-hmm. This show has to make money, and I don't want to ask my listenership for money. We may do that for special projects, like if I'm going to do a documentary or I want to fund a documentary, we might do that by taking donations. But I want marketing alone and advertisers to come in and market on the show. And we've had a few that have come on. They've been very happy with the marketing that we've done for them, and they've signed back up. And so we're keeping marketers, which is a really good thing. But for me, it's about acquisition of subscribers. So I want a listener. And what does it cost me to get a listener? Because I know once the show grows to 20 to 50,000 listeners a day, I know what that will return. And I know that when I do that, I can get into really big groups of top level marketing firms. So these are guys like, if mattress.com wants to do advertising, right? Well, they don't go to podcasts and say, hey, we want you to advertise on, can we advertise on your show? They go to a big distributor or a big advertising company that has all these podcasts, and they say, hey, we want to spend $100,000 to advertise on podcasts, so give us a nice disbursement. But you have to be doing enough volume, so to speak, to make it worth everybody's while for you to do that. So for me, it's about acquisition of listeners. How do I get my message out there, and how much does it cost me to acquire a listener? And this is probably terribly boring for anybody who isn't into marketing.
You'd be surprised.
It's a great, because that's the exact, are you familiar with like in startups, the it's the customer acquisition model, or the, what is the customer development model?
Yes, and well, and it's the same. It's,
yep.
Ultimately, it's if what you're trying to do is you're trying to turn over a dollar and get $1.25 back.
Exactly.
And you're saying, all right, if I give you a dollar and I know I can get $1.25 back, how soon can I make that happen? Like, does it take me a week? Does it take me a month? And so what I'm looking at is with the advertising that I'm doing, I'm just simply saying, what does it cost for me to acquire a subscriber?
Mm-hmm.
And right now it's costing me around $2 mm-hmm. to reach a person who likes my show enough to subscribe and listen every day. So that's about $2 per subscriber. So if I'm trying to get to 40,000 subscribers, 40,000 listeners a day, that means I'm going to have to spend about $80,000 to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, can I find that many people? Where do I have to go to get them? There's all kinds of other questions. But if I'm acquiring for around $2 a listener, then I know that's where I have to go to get there. And so it's just simply a matter of spending the money.
Right.
And what you try and do is you try and start offsetting through advertising revenue as much as you can, and just pouring all of the money that you make on the show back into advertising to continue to grow.
Right. And then eventually growth is self-sustaining at a certain
that's
point.
That's right.
Because
yeah,
you're such
it
a
is.
Big brand,
and then
you
what
don't
should happen
need to
is,
acquire by, for $2.
Yeah, you're right. And so what should happen is you should hit a break point where at 20,000 or 30,000 subscribers that you ought to be able to generate around 20,000 or so a month in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And once you can do that, well, now the sky is really the limit. Now you can now you have lots of leeway to advertise, to pay yourself, to
even raise money to grow more and faster.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. See,
and so that's what we're doing.
Yeah. So you have like a whole business model and a whole theory, and we're just over here like, hey, PayPal us some money.
Did you see that dank meme?
Yeah. Like, here, meme us, bro. Like we. And I mean, there have been points where we've thought about like monetizing this to a significant, you know, making it a business. But, you know, it's just a hobby for us. And you asked us off air, like, hey, why don't you monetize this? And because you have the listenership, it's like, meh, just PayPal us and we'll offset our costs so we can continue to make everyone happy. Like when you PayPal us at chrisspangle@gmail.com. Like, all that money just goes right back into offsetting hosting costs, if we ever need upgrades, some Facebook advertising. But
Harry's reparations.
Harry's reparations payment. Joe's bail when he gets caught getting
hopping
wild.
The border.
Right, hopping to the border. We're making
well,
our guests.
There's nothing wrong with doing what you guys are doing either. There's nothing wrong with just liking what you do and growing a really big show of committed diehard fans and just enjoying spending the week together. There's nothing wrong with that. It's very admirable. When I started my show, it was with the intention of doing something really big.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm, and I talk big to my audience. I say, you know, we're going somewhere with this.
Yep.
I have the intention to really make a change in the Liberty Movement because I feel like we're losing the war, guys. I really do.
Me too.
I feel like you got more and more people who are coming to the Liberty side or even to the Tea Party side if you go just a little bit more right wing. But the problem with that is they're not coming to it because our message is having an effect on society and culture. What's happening is the progressive message is taking hold. And more people are just finally throwing their hands up and saying, I just don't want to go any further towards statism.
Mm-hmm.
And the liberty message is starting to resonate. But it's not because we're winning anything.
No.
And we have a massive messaging problem. And it's something that I'm desperately trying to fix.
Because the Tea Party movement, realistically, if the Libertarian Party had, you know, done similar to what you said, that would have been unnecessary. They could have just come right into the wings.
I use the Tea Party as an example. I say the Tea Party, how long have libertarians been pushing their message? How long was Ron Paul in Congress? Or in the Senate, excuse me. And where is the libertarian movement now? Now look at the Tea Party in the last roughly 10 years or so. Even less. It's probably
yeah, no, 4 years.
Years now, right?
Yeah, about
they've,
four
they've
years.
They've had massive progress. Massive. Because they're willing to take inches. They're willing to take inches rather than take a whole mile.
Yeah, they won't and test you when you want to apply.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so I said there is a lesson to be learned there. You don't have to love the Tea Party and what they stand for to understand that they have been entirely more effective at spreading their message and what they want to accomplish than we have been. And they're very much outsiders in the Republican Party. Republicans don't like Tea Party folks.
Yeah.
No. I mean, they single-handedly eliminated Eric Cantor And that guy,
yes, they did.
You would have thought he had the most safe seat. I mean, being the – well, he was
– they took out Boehner and the second
well, – they almost took out Boehner.
Almost took him out. Yeah. Apparently, he's still on the throne for the time being. That was the craziest thing today.
And then Mike McCarthy.
Yeah. Kevin McCarthy.
Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. Out of California.
Mike McCarthy's the Green Bay Packers coach, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Excellent. Look at me. You in sport ball.
Look at me. I sported right. I don't know anything about sports, and somebody every Colts game on my Facebook, I always post the Colts keys to victory.
Isn't your job, aren't they like sports comedy guys?
No, they do a little bit of sports talk, but just like enough to make jokes about it. I mean, it is part of guy culture is sports, and I'm so illiterate when it, I mean, like,
oh, I don't know anything either.
Yeah,
you're
like
in good company.
Really,
I know like
yeah,
Adrian.
No, I know nothing.
Yeah, I know Adrian Peterson, and I know he's a really good guy. And like, I know
he wrote
about
a book on childing, right?
Yeah,
or child raising,
child rearing. He's basically the Dr. Spock of our generation. Like, I know about Michael Vick and the homeless shelter that he started
for dogs,
where he connects dogs with homeless veterans. Like, I know a lot about the NFL, but. No, so I post the Colts keys to victory, and somebody just got mad while we were hitting, like, where's the keys to victory? Because the Colts apparently are playing, and I just was like, the keys to victory are not going to happen this week because I didn't know there was a game. I just don't get the worshiping of the accomplishments of other men. I mean, I know Greg is a sports fan, but to me, like, I am not opposed to like being a sports fan, not in the least. Like, I'm not one of these. Like, I think libertarians, let's do another PSA and beat up on our own kind. Stop being the asshole. Oh, look at this! It's just Rome. They're throwing breads and circuses at the Super Bowl. Like, you know, it's just part of. You can have hobbies. Just because your hobbies are reading Hayek and annoying me on Facebook,
yeah,
it doesn't mean that your friends can't enjoy sports. It's just when I sit next to some people at BW3s, four grown men who sit at a table for an hour talking about fantasy football like it's actually happening in their real life, I want to throw up. Like, it's out of control. But
in the military, we had a term, it's a saying, it's called secure the happiness. And a lot of times I feel like that's what libertarians are doing. Anytime you try and have any fun or do anything kind of, you know,
okay.
Like you said, like, secure the happiness, no fun. Best, stop with the fun.
Best example of this just happened on my Facebook again. Okay, so this, I think he's a listener, Derek Virginia.
Yeah, he is.
Derek Virgin. He
oh, he's a libertarian.
He wrote on my wall, a libertarian walks into a bar, dies because there were no regulations assuring the beer wasn't poison. Okay, just a simple joke about libertarianism and there being no regulation, whatever. Nathan Thomas, God bless you, writes, such a red herring. A bar that serves poison will soon lack the customers and shut down. It behooves the bar not to do so. Derek perfectly responds, perfect libertarian response. Nathan does not get it and continues arguing. Derek finally says it's a joke, and then Joe Bryant spends at least an hour typing out a response to this. It's just like libertarians ruin comedy. They ruin
Can I just say how much I hate social media?
Really?
I really do. I have a private Facebook page for the show. I spend the bulk of my time there because I like most of the people who are there. And but I spend as little time other than that on social media as humanly possible.
See, that's what I do for a living. I'm on it way too much.
It's tough for you because you have to be there.
Yeah.
And I have to be there for what I do, too. I just don't really care for it. I think if I watched this show on Discovery Channel called, what is it? I don't know, like Alaskan Hillbillies or something like that. They basically like live off the land.
The Palins.
Right? And I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's a bit of that that's really appealing to me. Just go up in the cabin. Uh-huh. Nobody's around. Nobody's messing with me. No computers. No television. And that'd be fun for about 6 hours.
Right.
And then I'd be ready to come back. But there's something about that appeals to me because I get so fed up with these keyboard warriors.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, the world is a wonderful place except for the people. I've always maintained that.
Now, you mentioned Glenn Beck. Can we talk about meeting him? Are you
okay?
Oh,
yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
So I don't care what you think about all of his beliefs and positions. If you have strong beliefs against Glenn Beck, you've probably not listened to him in many years. I have not listened in a few months, but I will say that when I have tuned in, I have found him moving more and more and more libertarian to the point of even non-interventionism. But his business and the things that he is creating are so darn impressive. And I just think the world of what Glenn Beck is building. That's going to be a pulled quote someday. But
well, no, you want the inside skinny on that.
Yeah, and so you actually met Glenn Beck.
Yeah, so here's the whole story. So I don't have any opinion about Glenn Beck's politics at all. Frankly, because I can't tell whether he really believes what he's saying or whether it's all designed to garner more marketing. It's a really good marketing ploy, because I think Glenn Beck is one of the most underrated marketers alive today. What he's built is just incredible. He was the only guy who's been able to move off of cable onto the internet to start what is the equivalent of his own legitimate online television network, get it put back on cable TV, and to employ over 300 people who work for him. And I was impressed. And so when I built my studio out, we did it. If you look at it, you can tell it was, number one, I did it because it was the cheapest way I could do it for design, was to just put pictures on the wall and little trinkets in the background on shelves. But I also really liked the way Glenn had designed his studio, and so I modeled it after that. And anybody who looks at it can tell that's what we did. And I had the opportunity to go down there and meet with him. Not to pay him a lot of money to do that. But that's typically what people don't understand is, if you want exposure, a really easy way to do it is to pay for it. Just buy it. So I spent like $5,000, and for $5,000, I could go down there and spend the day. I could talk with Glenn Beck a little bit, see the studio, look at what they were doing with their new, because they're starting a movie company, and they were trying to raise money for that. So I spent the money and went down there, and the whole purpose of me going down there was to see the studio, to see how it was built, to look at how it worked, to try and figure out what they were doing and how they were running it, how many people they had. It was a pure fishing expedition on my part, because I wanted to see what this guy was doing behind the scenes. And got a chance to talk with him for a few minutes. He was very polite. He was very kind. I felt like when we chatted that he was very genuine. I don't know because I was there, and you know, I was technically a paying customer, so I don't know. You don't ever get to really know a person until you're behind closed doors with them. But I felt like he was a decent human being. He struck me that way. I've heard other radio announcers say different things about him, but I can't speak to that.
I worked with someone who worked with him in the 90s, and everything that he says about himself in the 90s is absolutely true, according to this woman. But okay. Trust me, working with radio people, not the people I work with now, but the people I've worked with in the past, anyone who is incredibly successful in a business that is largely built around
the cult of their personality.
A cult of personality, insecure people who are desperately seeking attention and affirmation from other people. Don't like successful people. They snipe at the people who are successful, and even when they're successful themselves, they snipe at people who are just a success. You know, it's a crazy business, but that's how it goes. But so I genuinely think I've met him 3 or 4 times, and I have always found him to be exceedingly polite. Very intent. You can always tell the character of somebody by how they treat a person's producer. So when they would walk into Abdul's studio, would they treat me with respect as his producer, or would they just focus on the host? You know, and Glenn went out of his way to make sure that every single person who worked for the station, every single person who showed up to his book signings, that they all got a photo, they all got their autograph, they all got a chance to meet him. And, you know, I hung with him backstage at one of his stage shows here in Indianapolis, and just seems like a very genuine guy.
Well, that was the impression I got from him, too. So And that's the only comment I could make as to his character, because I didn't spend a lot of time with him. But so anyway, that's why I went down there, was to look at the studio and to kind of on a fishing expedition. What I found was there was virtually nothing that they were doing that we weren't doing. There's nothing that they were doing we couldn't do. That was one of my big things, was to get to the level that he's at, what does it require? Well, all it requires is a little more expensive camera equipment and a bigger crew. That was all it was required in order to create what he had created there. And so I came home feeling really confident about what we were doing. And we recently invested in some new camera jibs and stuff, so we can do moving shots and pans and stuff like that in our studio. And my hope is that we will be able to do some really cool interview stuff and some really cool training and discussions using that studio. And that was why I went down there.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to, is money. I mean, you wanna say, hey, why aren't you doing more of Weird Libertarian? It's like money, time.
Look, brother.
Yeah,
it always comes down to money.
Always.
It really does. And as much as people might not like that, and they might not like the fact that they have to rely so heavily on money, it's better to have a lot of it than not very much of it.
I work for a nationally syndicated radio show with 2 million listeners every second that the show is on, and it's always about money. It is constantly about money. I mean, it's just,
yep,
you know, how do we upgrade this equipment? And trust me, the more equipment you got, the more money you got, the more problems you got.
Well, the more pressure there is.
That's why I have no problems. I have no equipment and no money.
Just now, the opinions I believe the American public needs.
Yes. So, Blackwater, that is an interesting thing. I don't know how much you can say before you have to kill us. But
I can't talk about it. It's all secret.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Interesting.
What did Dick Cheney smell like?
If you guys want to know about it, I can tell you.
How much money did you make, and how many people have you killed? I'm just kidding. I'm trying to be as impolite as possible to our guests.
I refuse to answer the second question. The first question was, it depends on the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, contracts could be as much as $1,000 a day. That's days boots on ground. Towards the end of my contracting career, it was running somewhere around $600 to $750 a day.
What did you, like, Blackwater is so tarred from some of the scandals that happened. I mean, what was the culture like inside Blackwater, and what is your, let's talk about the culture inside Blackwater. I mean, did the press match what you experienced?
In some cases, they hit the nail on the head. In most cases, they didn't. What the problem with, as is the case in most cases, is government really created something, took something that was very good and made it something very bad. And what I mean by that is, when Blackwater first started, Eric Prince created a firm that hired only former special operations guys. And they did very high-risk jobs in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then what happened was, the government decided to give them some bigger contracts and required them to fill more and more boots on the ground every single day. And they started a program called WIPS. And WIPS was a program, a vetting process for anybody who wanted to go downrange, to make sure that you were qualified. So it took both a resume that was accepted that met the minimum standard, and then you had to come out and prove what you did. And the first contract that I went on in 2005, I remember, I thought, I mean, I came from a special operations unit. I was with a force reconnaissance unit in the Marines. And every day I was going through that training and that vetting process. It wasn't a training, it was really a vetting process. And every day I was going through that vetting process, I would come back to the room, and my roommate was a former Green Beret. And I would be like, dude, you just feel like they're going to drop you every single minute? And he was like, yeah, man, I really feel like they're just waiting, looking for a reason to get rid of us. Because the standards were really, really high at that point. But a few years down the road, the government was requiring Blackwater to have 1,000 men on rotation on the ground at any given time. Now, there's not that many special operations guys available, mm-hmm. and not even available in the world, much less guys you can get to go down range. Mm-hmm. And so the standard went from only special operations guys to special operations and like attachments to guys who were just in the regular military but had some security experience. And what happened was when the standard fell off on the quality of guy that you got, so did a lot of the incidents. Plus, when you have more boots on the ground, there's more cases of incident and more risk of incident. And so there were most definitely guys who worked for Blackwater that had no business being downrange. But Blackwater did the best it could of vetting those people and getting rid of them when they poked their head up.
Now, Jason, so you worked how long with Blackwater? Or is that classified?
Well, Blackwater had another company called Greystone. It was an offshore company that they ran all of their non-government security work through.
Gotcha.
So I spent some time with Blackwater and some time with Greystone, a total of about 5 years.
Interesting. Oh, wow. That's incredible. Because, like, if you look at it right now, I actually haven't read anywhere if there are any Blackwater employees currently in Syria. I've read about private individuals, U.S. former Marines that are in Syria right now working over there. But I haven't actually read about government contractors. Are you aware of what that population would be like, or how many of
guys who work that I know who work in that space. I'm not really at liberty to discuss where they are or what they're working on.
Oh yeah,
What I will tell you is Blackwater no longer exists in its old form. The old Blackwater is gone. It's now called Academy. I still know people who work for Academy. They say it's very very different than it was early on. When I was working for them, so it's changed quite a bit. The industry itself has changed quite a bit,
right? And there's multiple providers, right? There's multiple providers.
Yes, there are Blackwater, Triple Canopy, Dynacor, Global Resource Solutions.
That's innovative.
Global Resource Solutions. British. What's that?
Global Resource Solutions. That's quite an innovative name.
Yeah, I think that's the name of them. I can't remember. Global is what everybody called them.
Yeah.
And those are just the American companies. And you've got Australian and British companies. You've got all kinds of different groups out there.
Now, that being said, I know you've been following the Russian intervention quite closely in Syria, correct?
Yes.
Have you would it be too much of a stretch to say that based on the intelligence the Russians would get and based on the United States' lack of success in training quote-unquote moderate rebels, would that training be administered by a private company in order to being able to dismiss any guilt? Or is it something where we would actually use Marines to do the training, which as of today would look that it's been the individuals we're trying to train and develop and fight look like they can't exact, or there just hasn't been any success.
Are you talking about the training of the Syrian rebels?
Yes.
The good rebels?
Yes. Al-Qaeda light.
Right. Al-Qaeda light.
Yeah.
Those type of training operations, the ones that I know of that are being conducted by the Pentagon would typically be conducted by U.S. Special Forces.
Okay.
In conjunction, oftentimes with a private corporation assisting.
Acting almost like as an administrator and liaison.
Oftentimes the Pentagon or the Army may act as the liaison, and you may have the private company actually administering the training.
Gotcha.
Now, on the spook side of it, if you look at the CIA and what they do, they almost always will use third-party contractors.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Kind of a CYA for them.
Yeah, well, not only that, they'll have guys on the ground, but it's just for them. I mean, there are CIA contracts that guys can work on and that you can apply for. Sometimes the pay is better or worse, and, you know, it just depends on what comes up and what they need you to do. And so those guys are working all the time in different capacities in the private sector for those agencies. Now, so if you're asking whether or not, I mean, personally, I think you shouldn't have those guys doing that anyway, because you shouldn't be engaged in that type of operation.
Right.
One of the things I learned about being downrange is that all of that stuff's a total waste of time, and it's a massive money pit.
Oh, $500 million for five trained fighters?
Oh, no, yeah, not only that, it's just, I mean, if you look at the waste and abuse, it's massive.
Yeah.
Still there?
Yep, we're still here.
Yep, we managed to save it. Thanks, Internet.
All right.
And so, yeah, with someone with your experience, what would you like? For instance, what are your thoughts just off the top? You know, you've given it serious thought on Putin's intervention. What I think we probably agree on what his intentions are by intervening, and then also what is a possible solution if Assad is not the solution?
I think it's great that he wants to come in and invest his money and his blood and his resources into fighting ISIS. And, you know, I don't particularly care about Assad. I can take him or leave him. If he leaves, he's going to create a vacuum that's going to have to be filled by somebody. But I think that in a best case scenario, Russia will push ISIS back and they will create more stability in the region, and they'll do what the U.S. has been unable or unwilling to do. That's the best case scenario. Worst case scenario, which could also be the best case scenario, is that Russia ends up getting caught in the same quagmire we were in, and they spend the next decade fighting terrorism in the Middle East for somebody else's regime. And I think either one of those scenarios is better than the U.S. doing those things. And so my advice to anyone who asks is to simply disengage, to simply leave, and to allow a sense of stability to come back, even if it means that evil dictators move back in and take over control of those countries.
Okay. Now, for me, from my perspective, and tell me what you think about this, is I think the biggest issue we've been having is that I think Vladimir Putin is actually nervous of the beginnings of a relationship between the United States and Iran. Mm-hmm. And granted, the Ayatollah, he is the populist, or I guess the Shia populist, you know, death to America, but because he was the instrumental leader in the revolution. But I think there's a developing middle class that is just so sick of the economic dismay, they are readily eager to enter into a nuclear disarmament agreement in the interim that ultimately will probably never be able to completely prevent. But the Russians have Assad as a proxy, I would say. And it's not so much that Iran has seen Assad as, you know, their puppet in Syria, but, you know, Hezbollah's over there assisting right now Assad's troops, as is the Quds. And I think it's funny that he was so swift and decisive in intervening, you know, bringing in taking ships to TARDIS, bringing in and arming the Syrian military so they can conduct airstrikes. And their first strikes were on people we were rumored to have assisted and trained and backed, the Al-Qaeda-lite rebels. And yet, if Putin's there, is it even a situation where he can get Assad's authority back and get control over a large enough swath of land where he can never pull out? I mean, is this an Iraq situation, or is it he's just waiting until he's rebuilding the relationship with Iran and keeping us out of that, and then Iran will really be the one who has an invested interest in Syria?
Yeah, you know, I think that your position is certainly plausible. I don't think it's as likely as just understanding that Putin has a vested interest in making sure that there is stability in his neighbors to the West. And it also gives him a chance to solidify and strengthen relationships with people in those countries. Now, he's always been a fan and a backer of Assad.
Right.
He and Iran have always been on good terms, or okay terms.
Strategic interests were that. Yeah.
Yeah, strategic interests. Yeah. And so I think it is much more likely that he sees this as an opportunity for him to come in and think about this from a power play with the U.S. They come over and they say, you guys have been a total failure, America. You guys have ruined this whole thing. And now we're coming in and we're going to fix it. So it's time for you guys to leave. And America says, well, we're not leaving. This is our show. And if you want to do something, you can coordinate with us. And they say, well, we're landing our ships and our airplanes and we're going to start bombing campaigns. So you need to leave. And America says, no, we're not leaving. And so they start their bombing campaigns. And what's the first thing that they bomb? They bomb U.S. interests.
Yeah,
right?
Immediately. The very now, first targets they or the first strikes.
Now, don't think that that's on accident. There's what they said to America was, we told you, we said your time here is done. It's time for you to leave. And if you're not going to listen, this is what's going to happen to you. They didn't shoot down an American warplane because that would have caused a real problem. But if they bomb some secret CIA base training secret spies, CIA wannabes for Syria, then that they can get away with. Putin is not a – he's a savvy guy.
Mm.
And I think that this has more to do with Russia trying to position itself as a world power again. It is doing everything it can to create alternative currencies and alternative means of selling oil.
Oh, yeah.
To cut the U.S. out of everything. And I think this is another way for them to show to their partners, to their supporters, look, America is not as strong as you think it is. Just watch what we're going to do. I think that is a much more plausible scenario.
Right. I guess the question is, like, even though, I mean, he becomes, assuming they are successful in pushing back ISIS, you know, the other group there is the Jabhat al-Nusra and the al-Nusra Front, mm-hmm. who has, you know, the leader of that, Jalani, has a issue with Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, over, actually, when, you know, al-Qaeda in Iraq was pledged to Zawahiri. And then when they broke, they had a serious issue. And the Jabhat al-Nusra is much more the populist on the side of the Sunnis in Syria. And then you have the Alawite Shia, who are the Assad's branch of Shia Islam and his ancestors. And Assad, even though he is a guy that gasses his own people, I mean, that's what his father did to put down a rebellion. That's what he did.
He makes the trains run on time.
Right.
But.
Well, no. So the the Assad family rose to power because after the French divvied it up, they were the Shia minority, the Alawite minority, and they cozied up with the French and filled in the power vacuum and said, we'll be your puppet.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime there was an uprising, the only thing that's been successful is outright devastation. And the United States, after John Kerry drew a fake red line. It's a red line that's not a red line?
Bullshit.
Yeah. After he did that, they really called our bluff, but now we're at the point where Assad, to my knowledge, doesn't control a single oil field any longer. The people that do support him, the minority Shia and then the few Christians, they are really already concerned about their safety and what's going to happen post this intervention. And yet today in Assad's hometown, they were cheering Russians at the TARDIS port as the saviors and hailing Russians. And even though Vladimir Putin, let's say he pulls this off and he is able to get Assad to have a big enough swath of land that he controls it, they're there forever. There's no leaving unless right. The Iranians share the cost. And
I think that's probably true. But I think what's important for your listeners to understand is that there are no good guys in this scenario. There's no guys in white hats here.
Mm-hmm.
All of these guys are bad guys. Al-Nusra, ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, all of these guys are bad guys in there, and Assad is a bad guy.
Right.
And one of the things I said, I was on RT America, and I was talking with Ben Swan, and he said, he was asking me some questions about it, and I said, you got to understand how evil dictators become evil dictators. The reason that Assad has been able to control and maintain power for as long as he's been able to do in a region where tribal warfare is a common occurrence is he's more evil than the next guy. He's willing to gas his own people in order to maintain power, right?
Exactly.
And now you've got a group of other people that are trying to overthrow Assad so they can impose their evil dictates on people. It's not as though you're going to install a democratic power there. It's not all of a sudden these guys are going to throw their hands up and say, oh, we want liberty. That's one of my biggest takeaways from being in Iraq and Afghanistan. These people do not want liberty. They don't want freedom. We want to give it to them, but they don't want it. And as soon as they get the chance to reinstall a new dictator, that's exactly what they're going to do. And so you're right. Russia can spend decades living in there, setting up bases and doing the same thing that we did in Iraq for a decade. And they're going to continue to fight these little insurgencies the whole stinking time mm-hmm. until one day Russia decides to leave. The power vacuum gets filled. There's a whole lot of more bloodshed and dying and death. And then pretty soon the thing stabilizes with a new evil dictator in power. That's the way this thing is going to work out. It's the way it always works out.
Yeah. I guess that's the question. Isn't that tough from a libertarian perspective? Because there's a thought that, you know, we're sort of marching towards something that, you know, liberty spreading. And obviously in this world, I would, it's hard to see that. Like, we had a bit of an upswing in the American media with Edward Snowden and Rand Paul and, you know, the filibusters and that type of thing. But then I feel like now we're actually further behind where we were at that point. And so if the libertarian, I struggle to believe that we're on a process where it's, you know, give and take until we ultimately arrive at the destination of human freedom, when religion is such an influential issue, not only in the Middle East in governing philosophy, but lifestyle. Let's say, for instance, in the United States, North America, we had a more libertarian society, or like sort of the original constitutional republic that stayed constrained. How do you handle an expansionist movement that's a religious philosophy with an absolute end time pursuit?
Well, I don't think that you do. You're dealing with some, you know, some really complex geopolitical issues, and I think for me, if we just look at this from the standpoint of America and the borders that we have drawn, and I think that our responsibility is to ensure that when you're within these borders, you're free, that okay. we maintain a right to life, liberty, and property here, and that's our responsibility. We don't have a responsibility to try and give freedom to other people because, like you said, most of them do not want it. For example, in the Middle East, part of the Muslim culture is they have a belief that man cannot be ruled by man. Mm-hmm. Man must be ruled by God. So the very idea that you're going to institute a constitutional republic where people get to vote on what laws they want to have is ludicrous to them. It can't be. It violates their entire culture.
It's also a tribal culture. I
mean, it is very much a tribal culture. And so my point being is that we have more than enough to deal with here at home. And I have always been a believer that we use military, we use violence only to defend liberty, only to defend our individual liberty. And if you want to come here and live here, you can do that. But we're not going to go and try and fight and preserve or provide liberty elsewhere. Our job is to provide it here at home for the people who reside within these borders.
And we have a hard enough time getting them to want it.
I would argue,
that's right.
Yeah, I would argue that our founding was intended that way. But
yes.
At this point, the use of violence, I mean, if you take it down to a philosophical level, you know, we use violence to get you to pay taxes. It's the threat of violence, mm-hmm. not actual violence. You know, it's the threat of being incarcerated, or, you know, it's still force. You know, force has become an incredible tool in our society, and you see the erosion of our culture. A lot of it has to do with the fact that violence is our first instinct. Anger is our first instinct in this society anymore. You know, everybody's got to be outraged and angry and pissed off, as opposed to live and let live. Let them live their lives as they see fit. You know, the further we drift away from the use of force only being used to protect liberty and more towards, well, now I have this particular view of how people ought to live their life, so I'm going to use the force of government to make them live the way that I see fit, the more we see violence in our own communities start to spring forth.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. And so what I would say is the government exists to protect life, liberty, and property, and nothing more. It doesn't exist to make sure there's an even playing field. It doesn't exist to make sure everybody's got an education or that everybody has access to health care. Government doesn't exist for that. Government exists to make sure that there are no impediments to you pursuing your own self-interest. And that in the event that someone does step in your way, that there is a process by which you can seek a redress of grievances, a court system of some kind. Now, that can be a court system like we have today, or it can be smaller, independent court systems, much more along the lines of what anarchists would want in a form of arbitration court. I'm not opposed to any one of those. My point is just simply saying we're so far away from that right now. Let's not talk about the best, you know, society that we're going to create sometime in the future. Let's figure out what's happening today and how we start addressing it from a libertarian perspective.
Okay. Let's jump into the House Speaker's race, because this is all really weird to me. John Boehner has been losing control of the caucus for a long time. And we have, a power vacuum essentially right now, where John Boehner decided to step down, and Mike McCarthy, who was his, you know, second in command, he's the majority leader, he's sort of the next one that you think is going to step up, decided today that he's not going to actually run. And I guess Congress people were crying, and his supporters were crying in the cloakroom, and everybody's just panicking because it's just total chaos.
It's the end of the Republic.
It's the end of the Republic, and this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause. But there is no real clear successor. Jason Chaffetz is running for Libertarians. I think he's a guy who Glenn Beck was really tight with.
Mormons. They stick together.
Stuff.
Talk about tribes.
And then I don't know if they had a falling out or what, but Chaffetz is not necessarily Libertarian. Paul Ryan is being discussed as sort of the only guy who can kind of bring all the sides together. But
won't do it.
No, this is a position to me that seems like career suicide if you're up and coming. I mean, you want to be a guy like John Boehner who, like, this is the top of the, this is how far you were going. You know, mm-hmm. If you're Paul Ryan who has presidential aspirations, there's no reason for you to ever take this. I'm not sure.
Well, what I think happened was I think Boehner just finally decided, look, I don't have any, I can't get anything done. I'm sick and tired of this. I'm not going any higher than this. It's not like I'm going to run for president. What am I doing this for? I'm done. This has been a big mess and I can't get control of this party. And so I'm going to step aside. And what I'll do is I'll arrange it so that my good buddy, McCarthy he's installed behind me. Mm-hmm. And that was the plan from the get-go. The problem is when they showed up today, they did a little quick head count and they realized they didn't have the votes.
Yeah.
And so McCarthy, rather than going to a vote and realizing and not being able to save face, he just simply said, I'm going to withdraw for the sake of the party. And it just sent everybody into a tizzy. But what I can't believe is people crying in the cloakroom.
Yeah,
that was like, that's beyond me that people would cry over something so trivial and stupid.
Maybe it was just Boehner that was crying. I don't know.
Maybe it was. That guy cries about everything.
There's nothing wrong with being an emotional man, Jason.
No,
leave me alone.
Not, I mean, there's not. I'm just, he cries about everything. It's awkward to me.
I mean, I screenshotted a point where the Pope was looking up at, you know, he was behind the podium. And he was looking up at Boehner crying, and the Pope just has this look on his face like, really, dude? Really? I never did anything with it, but I should.
So I don't know what they're going to do now. Boehner says he's going to stick around until they can find somebody to replace him, and who knows? What it shows is there's total bedlam in the Republican Party, and it stems from this hardcore liberty movement in the Tea Party that is that's causing problems, mm-hmm. because they won't fall in line. They won't do what the rest of the Republicans want them to do.
They're constitutional, having trouble getting anything done. You know, they don't believe in you know, they all took pledges they wouldn't compromise on. Not an additional dollar of spending, only cuts. And the political reality is, it doesn't work like that. You know, there just isn't what Congress does. There aren't many bills that don't involve spending.
Well, I got to tell you guys, I like it when Congress doesn't get anything done.
Right.
There are very few things that Congress is doing on a day-to-day basis that really need to get done. The things that they really need to do, like pass a budget, they can't ever accomplish.
Mm-mm.
And, you know, they fight inside their own parties. They fight between parties. It's like, you know, and that's fine. I just wish they'd just shut the whole thing down. Let it go 6 or 8 months without funding any government, non-essential government operation, which to me, in and of itself, I don't know why you would have a non-essential government person working for the government. But apparently they've got tens of thousands of them that get furloughed every time the government gets shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish we would do that for a few months and let people realize, hey, half the stuff that the government does, we don't really need them to do that. Yeah.
You wouldn't notice. And like, even when we have government shutdowns, only about, 17% of the actual government shuts down?
Yeah.
The rest just keeps going.
Right.
Yep.
You know, what I don't like is the power vacuum that creates, because it allows whoever's the, you know, in the executive office to fill in that gap. You know, like during congressional recesses when he makes appointments. I just am real. That always really bugs me when someone won't act, our nature is when someone won't act, the person that's the president says, well, I'm required to. I have to do what's necessary to lead. And it's no really different than that sentiment of, like, you know, Lincoln suspending habeas corpus and imprisoning Supreme Court or justices and then doing, you know, justifying by saying, I'm actually trying to save the Republic by doing that. Do you not feel that way?
No, I absolutely feel that way. And there is a lot of what's frustrating to me is when you hear people who would be ardently opposed to such an action when Obama does it, hail it when Bush does it,
yeah,
or vice versa.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's this sense that, hey, if my guy is running the show, I love the fact that he screws over Congress and goes around the Constitution to get done what we need to get done. Yeah. But when it's the other guy, he's a criminal and he ought to be thrown in jail.
Yeah.
What we need to understand is most of these guys are borderline criminals. And,
oh, yeah,
and nobody's looking out for you. Nobody. That's what I try and tell my audience. Nobody is looking out for you. None of these guys have your best interest at heart. So you need to understand enough about what's going on that you at least know what your position is on it. Because these guys will screw you over six ways from Sunday if they think it'll help them get reelected.
Yep. I mean, look at Bush and the signing statements, you know, he used during his administration. Everybody's a small, you know, small government, constitutional Republican, you know, compassionate conservative until there's gridlock. And then a guy that probably took the oath on the Constitution over the Bible all of a sudden starts making power grabs and offering interpretations.
Yep.
It's sad.
Yeah. It's one more example of how big, you know, power corrupts.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really matter. I was listening to another podcast. It was Lions of Liberty. He had on this gal who owned a farm in some rural area somewhere. And they'd done a documentary on her called Farming in Fear. And it's just about how small government really screwed over this little gal and her farm. And I was talking with my audience about it, and I just said, listen, it doesn't matter whether it's big government at the federal level or whether it's your local mayor and local city council. If you don't put these guys in check, they will come after you. They'll try and violate your property rights. They'll try and violate your civil liberties. You've got to be Johnny on the spot. And what we need is, what I really think we need is, we need a cohesive message inside the libertarian movement that says, here's what we believe, here's what we're going to get behind, here's the direction we're going to go, and I'm going to do this, and anybody else who wants to join me can come along for the ride. And if we can do that, at least we can create a small group of people who are all actively moving in the same direction, rather than having this discombobulated minefield of competing ideas and infighting that we have in the Libertarian Party today.
So as far as politically, like how do you vote and how do you persuade your listeners to get politically active? Like at what level, what party? I mean, do you even get into that?
I get into some of it. I am still a registered Republican because I like to affect Republican primaries. And in my state, I cannot vote in a Republican primary if I am not a Republican. But last election cycle, I voted for the Libertarian candidate, and I will likely do either a write-in or the same this time, considering who I think is probably going to end up getting the nomination, because they won't get my vote. What I tell people is it starts at the local level. It starts with you getting active in your local community and at some political level. Because that's what it's really going to take. If we don't think we can change things politically, then the only other option we have is violence. And since I don't advocate violence, I don't think that we're at a place now where we have no other option but violence. I think that there is still a path. Then we need to pursue that to its end. And so I tell people it's important first that you get active and that you understand the issues and you be able to communicate them with your friends and relatives. And then one step beyond that would be local government. And then how they vote, who they vote for, that's their opinion. That's their decision. We talk about Rand Paul, and we've got some Ted Cruz, some guys who like Ted Cruz who listen to my show. And I'm whatever. That's how you vote and how you do that is your business. My business is to come out every single day and advocate for liberty. And so that's what I do.
Who do you think will be on your ballot in November for the Republican and the Democrat?
I think the Democrat will probably it depends. If Vice President
Biden
runs, thank you. Got all these names swimming around in my head. If Biden runs, I think Biden will be the nominee. If Biden doesn't run, I think there's a very good chance that we will see Bernie Sanders as the nominee.
Really?
Yes. I've heard that theory floated a lot, actually, that Biden gets in and splits the moderate vote from Hillary, and then Bernie, it gives Bernie an actual push and more money, more volunteers, and he could actually secure the nomination if Biden gets in.
I think if Biden gets in, he sucks votes from both sides. I think he sucks the Hillary vote away because Hillary's running on fumes now anyway. And
she's
I think they're going to he's going to suck the Sanders vote from anybody who just really hates Hillary and thinks she's despicable. And so they're going with a Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has a better grassroots campaign than any of the other candidates right now. On maybe in both parties. So I think it's going to be a Biden or a Sanders, depending on if Biden gets in or not. And then on the Republican side, it's almost too early to call, but I think Rand is out. I think Ted is out. I think you'll most likely end up with a Rubio or a Jeb Bush or somebody like that.
Not Donald Trump, huh?
No, I don't think Donald Trump will make it. I think he's a great mouthpiece. I think that he's stirring up a lot of excitement. I think he's going to have very little follow through.
Well, this just in, I just got an email from Donald Trump. You are a fat, ugly loser, and no one likes your podcast.
And I just have to ask Jason why he doesn't want America to be great again.
Yeah.
I can't figure that out, Jason.
That's right. Well, you know, and he's going to create, he told me he's going to create a lot of jobs, and I asked him how, and he said, I just will. I'm just going to do it.
Listen,
and that's good enough for me.
There you
go. I'm going to get rid of Obamacare, and I'm going to put in its place something fantastic.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And you know what? He's following an excellent marketing strategy. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing Obama did when he ran on hope and change. You know, he doesn't ever clearly define what it is that it means to have hope and change or what those actual principles mean in reality in terms of policy. He let anybody put anything on that they wanted to. And Donald Trump is doing largely the same thing. He's saying, I'm going to make America great again. Well, what does that mean? Well, it doesn't really matter what it means. It's just going to be fabulous. Just trust me. I'm very rich. Trust me.
I'm very rich. If you go and watch the Daily Show with Trevor Noah's Donald Trump is our first African president. I posted it up on the We Are Libertarians Facebook page. It is one of the best pieces from The Daily Show in the history of The Daily Show that I have ever seen. It's amazing.
Wow.
I'll have to go check it out.
It is so funny.
You know, though, I watched Bill Clinton on Stephen Colbert, Colbert the other night. And Bill was amazing. I mean, he's always amazing that, you know, Colbert set him up to crucify Trump. And he sat there and made the case and said, you know, you see all these politicians up there talking about how they're going to change things. When all of them are lifelong politicians and they've never changed anything.
Yeah.
And then you see one guy who actually has done things and it's like, well, maybe I'll pick the guy that, you know, has actually done things.
He's got pictures.
No doubt.
You know, Donald Trump has probably a vast collection of Bill Clinton photos that he's just been sitting on. Just like the documents that proves Barack Obama's not a citizen.
People forgot about that with Trump.
Can we touch on Rand Paul and why we think Rand Paul is probably done for? We've talked about it a little bit, but I've had a couple people write in and say, you know, hey, not the philosophical stuff aside, but why do you think Rand Paul is just not connecting with voters, Jason?
Well, I think he's not connecting because he doesn't have a very clear and concise and sustained message. He is not. He doesn't spark any sort of enthusiasm in me personally, and I think in anybody else. And he's trying to thread the needle between. See, I said at the beginning when he ran, I said, I'm afraid that people are going to project Ron Paul onto Rand Paul, and that Rand is going to be expected to come in and carry the torch for Ron. And I think Rand recognized that if he wanted to actually become president, he was going to have to modify the message a little bit. I think what he ended up doing was he ended up playing the game a little bit too much. And people in on the libertarian movement, his core base that he really needed to fund the campaign and to give him the support he needed, vaporized. Mm-hmm. Because, and I think people are kind of looking at it and they're saying, well, he's the most libertarian, so I'll hold my nose and vote for him, but I'm not real excited about him.
Yeah.
And every once in a while he comes out and says something amazing and you clap your hands. And then the next thing you know, he turns around and he's signing the, you know, the loyalty pledge for the Republican Party. And you just can't have that kind of inconsistency in your message. I mean, your message can be nothing more than I'm rich, I'm great, I'm fabulous, and we're going to make America great again. That is a better message than Rand Paul's convoluted message that he's been putting out. And it's just, it doesn't excite, it doesn't inspire, and nobody's getting behind it.
Yeah, you're saying exactly what I've said. The entirety of the Rand Paul presidency prospect has been present. It's a lot of alliteration there. I'm very proud of myself. Hope I don't break my arm patting myself on the back. Now, more about me. So I just have said from the very beginning, Rand Paul doesn't inspire anyone. He's a very technical speaker. What's the Adlai Stevenson of our generation in some ways, or Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater was not the best speaker, but he was
a leader.
He was a leader because he was so intent on what he believed, like Ron Paul was, and had such backbone that he'd stand up for it, that people followed him. They didn't care that he wasn't a good speaker. Rand Paul is wishy-washy, untrustworthy, slippery, and a politician. And
the most principled politician, though, in the Senate. Those aren't great adjectives.
Yeah, it's like being the best whore in the whorehouse. I mean, it's really not.
She's the one with the Christian heart.
Right, yeah. Well, look, she's got a heart of gold.
To be fair, he has a very good voting record.
Unbelievable.
You look at his voting record, it's very strong. And I always say, you know, you got to look at the way a guy votes if he's in politics, not what he says, because his vote will tell you who he really is. And it's clear that Rand Paul values liberty and values kind of the same things that we value, but he just doesn't inspire any confidence. And he's not a guy that you just feel like you want to get behind. And I think that's what you said, exactly what you said. It's been a problem since he started.
You know, I thought, and this was something I had gone through after the last debate, and I went through, and he was the only person that didn't say, when I am president, blank. Like, he doesn't, that's not in his language. He never talks about when he would actually be president, what he would do. All he talks about is he gives commentary and analysis on the existing problems. And when you don't present a vision, like, I still think the reason Trump's beating most people is because even though there's no specifics to a vision forward, it's a vision forward. It's a march towards something. Rand Paul has yet to lay out just what America would look like with under a Rand Paul presidency. You know, all he talks about is the negation. Well, we're going to stop the spying on you. And I get that is the tough part of being a libertarian and being a liberty-oriented candidate is, how do you take a negative or a negation and present that in a way that feels like we're looking out into the horizon and that's where we're headed?
Well, you paint a picture the same way Trump did. You say, mm-hmm. for example, I want you to imagine for a moment what this world would look like when everybody who wants a job has a job.
Right.
Where we stop punishing people and incarcerating them for years or decades for crimes that never hurt anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to envision a society where you feel safe putting your kids and letting them play on the street again.
Right.
You know, and you just crap. It doesn't matter. It could be from, I mean, this is just, it's marketing 101. That's why I say from the very beginning, these guys have a massive marketing problem. I've said on my show repeatedly, if you work for the Rand Paul campaign, call me. I will give you free advice. I will tell you how to win an election. They have yet to call.
And I'll tell you right now, you're not going to get that call.
Yeah. But that's how you paint that picture, because it doesn't have to be like I said, you don't have to present the roadmap. Well, how are you going to clean up the crime so my kid can play on the street? Well, those are things for later. I just want you to envision what it would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want you to attach that vision to me. That's how you do it. That's how Trump did it. Mm-hmm. That's why he's winning. That's how Obama did it when he ran for president. That's how you win.
Yep.
And unfortunately, none of these guys know that.
No. And the Republicans are already always on the defense. And so, I mean, Bernie Sanders should not be a viable candidate in a presidential election ever. But given outside, I mean, I think Donald would beat Bernie. I don't think Jeb would. I do.
I'm just saying, like, what a crappy choice.
That is the election America deserves. Yeah. Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump.
I might have to consider moving to Canada if those are my two choices. Oh boy. Canada's
great
already
call.
A lot freer than
nice
America.
Nice to have you on. Thanks.
We are not Canadian fans on this show.
Nope.
Is that
Sorry.
Right?
Oh,
well,
we do think that the imminent invasion is going to happen.
First,
just saying, if my choice is Trump or Sanders, Montreal might be in the cards for
oh,
me.
Oh boy.
I would stay here because it would be so much fun.
Oh yeah. Don't miss
kidding?
The party.
I work for a comedy radio show and I have a podcast where we do nothing but make fun of politicians. I'm praying
for
Trump, Bernie.
I've got my Bernie Sanders voice down, and so I've been telling the guys, I hope he goes all the way to the end because I really want to keep doing the voice.
I think it's hilarious. He wants us to be more Scandinavian, and he's a socialist from Vermont whose constituency is 95% white. Yeah. How could we be? What are you going to do to be more Scandinavian than that?
I guess he ran as a libertarian. He ran libertarian-ish at some point in his career. I posted the evidence up on the We Are Libertarians Facebook page. So go check that out. Well, we got to wrap up because I have to go to bed. I'm a very tired boy. I only got a 20-minute nap this afternoon. Here's how this ends. Okay? Not society, this podcast. We give each of us, we get to go around the table. If there's anything that we'd like to say, anything that you'd like to promote, I dare say if you'd like to do any self-promotion, there is no time limit, but please be respectful of the audience. And you may, if you miss something and we moved on too quickly, or if there's a topic we didn't get to, it's open season, Jason. So whatever you'd like to talk about, we can have Greg go first, or you can go first, and he'll show you how this is done if you'd like.
That'll work, Greg.
Sounds very complicated.
These are tricky. I want to make sure I got all the rules. So,
exactly
right. Give me a second.
Well, I would actually, I'll tell you what's been interesting to me is even though I supported Biden a long time ago, I am a little interested to see if he actually declares, because it sounds like they're going to let him participate in the debate without even declaring for president. And one issue we didn't talk about tonight, which we were originally planned to, but this has been a lot of fun. And Jason, thanks so much for coming on.
You bet.
It's been a blast to get to hang out with you digitally, and hopefully someday in the future we can do a live show or something like that.
You bet.
But I think that in the debate, Hillary's in serious trouble, especially with all the confusion going around. When her own attorneys are saying she needs a criminal defense attorney, there's something brewing. And Bernie Sanders isn't a real alternative, especially within the Democratic Party. The Republicans tolerated Ron Paul, but Democrats have no time for somebody that's a socialist. But I think there's a chance Jim Webb could stand out in a debate. And
yes.
I've always thought so.
I agree.
Also with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, looking like it's finalized.
Maya.
No, it's not about trans people that live in the Pacific. It's about our new, I guess you could say, global NAFTA.
Okay.
And there's been a lot of sticking points on how long you can a pharmaceutical company can compete and develop an alternative, in order to deliver the drug cheaper, like a generic. And I just think that it's going to be really tough. Joe Biden's going to do really well until it comes to this, and big labor is going to back Hillary or Bernie. And Jim Webb is going to stand out in the debate if he gets in and he gets enough questions, because you talk about a guy with command presence and absolutely no, at the moment, political support. But should he have a standing out moment, I could see a groundswell behind him if Biden has enough of an issue with the big labor that he isn't able to secure something or decides not to run.
I totally agree. I think Jim Webb is he's somebody that is conservative enough or conservative looking enough.
Mm-hmm.
He seems conservative enough.
Reagan's undersecretary of the Navy.
Yeah, that he he's got just that swagger and that confidence that he's a dangerous person.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, which I still cannot believe Bernie Sanders is in the discussion for real. Hi, Mittens. Okay, so it's just a free-for-all. Whatever you'd like to say, this is your time and opportunity. Go forth, young man.
All right, man. We have covered a lot, and it's been a really great time. And I just want to thank you, both of you guys, for having me on the show. And I had a really good time. And just, hey, if you guys, if your listeners like this and they want to hear something every single day, just come on over and give my show a listen. And if you don't like it, feel free to not send me an email. Just feel free to stop listening.
Go back in the basement.
And if you love it, make sure you send me an email.
Yeah. And we're issuing a command. This isn't maybe. Every listener, this is a fatwa. And if I find out that you didn't download Jason's show and become a subscriber, I will meme you to death. I will jihad John you digitally.
Thanks, guys. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the program. We have talked about this for months, and it's great to introduce you to our listeners. And please go check out jasonstapleton.com. See what a handsome man he is. You won't believe he's libertarian. He's so good looking. So, and his video podcasts are even better looking than he is. I don't know how it's possible. He must be very rich, very, very good looking. All right. Thank you for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. Thanks again to Jason Stapleton, Chloe, and Agnos. I don't know what happened to you. I hope you're all right. You were supposed to be here, but you didn't show up. No call, no show. It's very nice.
She Hollywooded us.
She Hollywooded us. She big-timed us. Just because mm-hmm. you're a beauty queen, it doesn't mean you can treat us this way. Okay, yes, you can. We're libertarians. All right. Thank you for joining us here on the podcast. And as always, we promise
to do better next time.